I'm here today with Stephen Downs, somebody that I incredibly discovered about by accompanying an Indonesian friend that was here in Rome a year ago to attend an international workshop about telecommunications. The guy was really lost here in the city and wanted to connect with some friend that he had known in an international workshop back over in Southeast Asia. And so he called me up and said, well, if you can give me a ride, that would be very nice so we can exchange and update some info. And as we were driving, we were exchanging info about what we were reading and blogs and newsletters and things. Actually, he wasn't even mentioning blogs at the time. This was over 2 years ago. And he said, well, Luigi, as that is my legal name by which he knew me at the time, you know, I strongly advise you give a look to this guy from Canada called Stephen Downs. He's got an interesting newsletter, and I surely think you would enjoy it. And so I did discover Stephen from Indonesia all the way to Rome and back to Canada for a person that I indeed truly enjoy. I like his free spirit. I like the research that he does, the reporting, systematic, precise, with always some insight. Stephen, you're out there in Canada, but tell all the people that don't know you yet, what are you doing out there?
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here. What I'm doing here is I'm a researcher for the National Research Council Canada. What that means is that I have a pretty free rein, which is very nice. I write some software, I write some papers, I talk to lots of people, I give talks, and basically tootle around in the field of online learning, trying to push the edges a little bit.
Good. What is actually your mission, if there is an official one?
Well, there is a vision statement on my website, which is not in front of me right now, but the short version of it is that what I'm up to is creating mechanisms such that everybody in the world can have free and open access to learning, because I think it's through learning that people are able to reach their greatest potential.
And what do you find being right now your greatest limitation in achieving these goals?
Well, I have to say the greatest limitation in achieving the goals is the fact that access to education and indeed access to educational content is to a large degree limited. Journal articles, online courses, you have to sign up for these. You have to pay fairly large tuitions. And these barriers are what's preventing open access to education.
So who is the responsibility for all these limitations growing in number around you?
The last part of your question was clipped, but I think you were asking who's responsible for these limitations. And basically, I mean, there's no individual responsible, no group responsible. There's no conspiracy here. What we have is basically the structure of the educational system prior to the possibility of free and accessible online content. And it's this structure which has always limited access. And the structure is made up of traditional educational institutions, publishers, and even to a degree governments.
I understand. I understand better now. Yes. Well, let me jump away a little bit from this hot topic, because both me and you like that very much, and I don't want to lose out all of the interesting things that I want to find out on this theme right at the beginning. I know that you, like me, you utilize a lot of tools. You're yourself a developer. For example, what is your basic computer that you work on?
Well, actually, I use several computers. My office desktop is a Linux system. It's a Dell computer. And I run Firefox and GFTP and Kwrite and the usual Linux set of tools. This conversation is happening on a laptop. It's a Dell laptop. It's a real slim one because I do a fair amount of travel, so it's not full capacity, but it runs Internet Explorer. It runs the usual Microsoft set of tools, although I typically use Firefox on it and Thunderbird as my email. My home system is very similar to my office system. It's a Linux. It's a SUSE Linux instead of a Mandrake. Backend, I'll use MySQL as my database, although most of my website is in the form of a native database that I wrote myself because I never had access to a database. And I was too poor to afford the internet service provider giving me one. Used an Apache server. I do a lot of, basically I write all of my code in plain text editors. I find that the easiest thing to do.
Great. So what brought you to make your first preferred platform choice, the Linux one?
Well, for me, it's been largely a question of cost. I mean, when you buy a system with Windows on it, all the other tools that you want to use are going to cost something. Text editor, word processor, anything that you're going to use, you have to pay money for. I wanted something that would do, for example, a sound recording for me. Well, in the Linux world, it's not particularly a problem, but it took me a long, long time in the Windows world before I was able to find Audacity, which is free. And which evolves out of the Linux world. Before then, it was always, oh, you have to pay $30 for this, $40 for that. And it adds up.
Certainly, certainly so. I hear you there. So in the Windows world, the one that you like the least because of the costs that are out there, are there freeware or shareware or open source tools that you are using and that you like very much outside of Firefox you just mentioned?
Well, I also mentioned briefly Audacity, which is a sound recording program that I've had a great deal of success with. It's completely free, and it exports sound in MP3 format so that anybody can listen to it. I've had a lot of success with that program. I've really liked it. On Windows, as a text editor, I use a program called NoteTab. It's very cheap, but you do have to pay for it. There is a free version available, which I did use for many years. I like NoteTab because it outputs data in a Unix format, and you need to be able to do that. Otherwise, your Perl scripts will crash on your web server. I learned that one the hard way. Thunderbird is my email client, and I use that a lot. And I will say the other program on my laptop that I use a lot is Microsoft PowerPoint. I do know that there are some open source presenter tools out there, but really PowerPoint is the tool that's doing that job for me right now.
What about search engines? Do you search a lot, and do you use Google as your unique resource?
Yeah, Google is pretty well it for me. I do check from time to time other search engines, whether there's an upgrade or anything like that. I always run a test. I have a standard test. Anytime I hit a search engine, I search for myself because I'm a big ego. Actually, no, it's because I know what to expect. I know what constitutes a good search and a bad search when I search for myself. And when I do that, Google consistently outperforms the others, both in terms of number of results, but also, and more importantly to me, in terms of accuracy of the ordering of the results.
Have you had any opportunity to try out any of the new search tools, the ones that extend your abilities maybe to your desktop or to enable fast indexing of all the content that you have across several servers or the like?
Well, I don't really keep a whole lot of content on my laptop, so the Windows toolbars that are available, I would have to use on my laptop, and don't really have a lot of use for them there. I haven't found anything for the Linux system yet for the desktop. But the thing is, I keep everything on my website, and anytime I upload a file, a presentation, audio, an article, a link, I input it all into my own online system. And my own online system has an internal search that I built myself. So that's pretty much what I use.
Great. What about the actual search performance? That is, yes, we like Google, but if you are to speculate a bit about the future of search outside of the individual companies playing in this field, what are your, rather than forecast, your wishes, what kind of search you'd be looking for in the future that it's hard to get right now?
Well, I think that we're going to move into a period that you might call beyond search. I mean, search is what you do when you don't know where something is, and you figure it might be out there, and you like to get it. But I think in the future we're going to move more and more to an environment where the resources that you need come to you, and that this happens automatically so that you don't need to conduct a search. That's a large part of what I'm working on. When I talk about RSS and when I talk about content networks, the eventual outcome of that is search that functions in the background that you never implement yourself, but that when you need a resource, the correct one, the appropriate one, is there ready for you to use.
So is that happening because you will set up in the background aggregators and filters or other automated mechanisms and tools that will pre-qualify what you may need?
Well, the short answer to that is yes. And the longer answer to that is that there's a network of these things. It's not something that I, as the user, has to set up in order to make this work. But it's a network that does get set up over time by a large number of people like me and like yourself.
I've recently put up, and you've positively responded to my desire to see an easy opportunity for syndicated content to be truly free, as the intrusion of advertising and the little explicit information available about RSS feeds prevents somehow the possibility of a free flowing of this information for full reuse. What's your more detailed take on this?
Well, my thinking is that we need to signify, and we need to do this just because of the environment that we work in. I personally don't think we should have to signify, but in the current environment, we need to signify that a given resource is available for sharing. That's very much what the Creative Commons project does, of course, with the little Creative Commons logos, and that this signification needs to go into the RSS feed describing the item in question. I'm not sure if you've seen the work that I've done on digital rights, but there's a model that I'm proposing called distributed digital rights management, in which a pointer to an open digital rights language file is contained in the metadata of a resource. And the ODRL file specifies the use conditions for a particular resource. If you have that, then the system that does your search for you can automatically sort or filter those materials that are available and free for use. So the idea here is, like, you don't create a separate portal for something like that. A separate portal isn't network thinking. You create a filtering mechanism within the network that will return to you just the type of resource that you want. And in this case, royalty-free, open-source, open-access kind of information.
Yes, but how do we get individual publishers in the first place to signify explicitly that their content is reusable?
It's got to be put right into the authoring tools. Again, if you look at the DDRM project that I described, this is specifically for learning objects and learning object metadata. When you're creating a learning object or learning object metadata, you have a button that takes you directly to a little wizard that will create the ODRL file for you. So in the process of creating these resources, basically, you select the rights model that you want to apply to the resource, and this becomes part of the metadata right from the point of creation.
So for people who are not in e-learning but are a simple publisher, this would have to appear inside their publishing tools like Blogger of movable type, LiveJournal, whatever they use.
That's exactly right. We're beginning to see that a little bit with Creative Commons, but I think that's the direction we're going to go, especially with things like advertising appearing in RSS feeds. Now there's going to be more of a commercial imperative to describe the terms of use, and with that commercial imperative will come the tool.
You've been mentioning RSS and learning objects. While I'm very familiar with the first, I've only fought with the second time on a few projects with my customers, and any time I bring up that subject, I get a lot of raised eyebrows because the term learning objects means many different things to different people. What's your personal definition of that?
Well, my personal definition is a functional definition, and any object, any resource can be a learning object. And what makes a learning object is the fact that it is actually used in support of education. And the proof of this is in the development of learning object metadata. Right now, there are educational metadata fields such as age range and topics and so on. And what happens is this metadata should be not created at the time of creation, but rather created at the time of use. And so when a resource is used in education, this metadata is created. When this metadata is created, that's what makes it a learning object.
Thank you. That's something that I understand and makes lots of sense. And it confirms that basically anything can be a learning object. Am I correct on that?
That's right. Right. I would also include in that non-digital resources, such as rooms in a school, instructors in a classroom, books, CDs, anything that can be described in metadata can be a learning object. And the placement of the educational metadata in the metadata is what makes it so.
Stephen, you work around and write a lot about RSS and learning objects. How are these two technologies going to profoundly change the way we approach learning in the near future?
Well, I think that the major way that they're going to change learning is that in the past we thought of learning as something that we do ahead of time. We do a lot of preparation for, we set up a structure for, we organize in a linear format, we bring together a cohort. It's all done in advance, it's all done just in case. And it's done that way because we know that when a person is out there in the world and needs to call on some sort of knowledge or to be able to learn something, that these opportunities are often not there. So they'd better be prepared. What RSS and what learning object metadata bring to us is the capacity to bring these resources to people wherever they may happen to be when these resources are needed. That means that you don't need to do as much preparation up front. And the preparation up front can be focused in a different area. It can be focused on things like the capacity to learn quickly on the fly rather than knowing all the capital cities of Europe. And so it's this content streaming thing that the new technology brings to us. It changes the flavor of learning. It changes it from being static and based on static resources to being dynamic, fluid, based on dynamic, fluid resources. In the old way, we had objects, which are books. In the new way, we need to think of learning resources and learning itself as more like a utility, more like electricity, more like water, something that's always there, always available, and flows rather than is delivered in static units.
So are we going to have still classrooms in the educational institution of the future?
Well, there's nothing in my approach to learning that says people should not get together in groups in real time. In fact, I encourage people getting together in groups in real time, and I think there's a lot of value to that. And if they do that, they need a room or a place to do it. And so, you know, what we call today classrooms are very likely to be the places where people get together in real time in order to communicate. But what happens in these rooms, I think, will change very much. What we've used classrooms for is as a delivery vehicle, a content delivery vehicle. You go to a classroom, and one way or another, somebody's going to send a bunch of educational information to you. But in the future, by the time a student gets to the classroom, all of that delivery will already have been done. And so the classroom will be used much more for communication and interaction. Now, this means the physical design of the room will no doubt change, and probably the name of the room will change as well, but the physical location is probably going to be the same.
Good. That's very interesting, and something that I fully share myself. Great take on it, Stephen. Let me ask you, the trainers, those online educators, which are all swarming to create fancy presentation and glitzy showcases, in many different ways. They are now awarding people who take the shortest time to create a flash presentation during e-learning conferences. What do you think of this drive they have, and what would be your advice to them with the time and resources they have available?
Yeah, I've seen some of those what do they call them, shootouts. I saw one, I guess it was a Brendan Hall thing? I think it was either that or a Macy thing. The challenge was to convert a PowerPoint presentation into, quote, e-learning in the shortest possible time. This sort of left me scratching my head because you're starting with a PowerPoint presentation. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear the hammering behind me. We have construction going on in the building because our building is just expanding. I think that, I mean, my main attitude toward that sort of work is that it's necessary training. We have a lot of people who are in the field of education spending a lot of time developing these flashy multimedia objects, and they may be used or they may not be used, but I think that the primary value of these at this point in time is the education of the person who's actually doing the creating. People need to learn for themselves to a large degree what works and what doesn't work. And the only way they're going to learn this is to get their hands dirty, to get in there, spend the time that it takes, and do something in Flash or whatever, and then roll it out and see what the pickup is. That said, you know, I mean, I like a good animation as much as anyone. I think that there's going to be an increasing role for games, and especially animated games, in learning in the future. So a lot of the basic skills that are going to be needed to build these more complex systems are being developed now. So even though the glitzy multimedia that we're seeing won't particularly have a huge impact in education, I think that the skills and the practices being learned through this stage will play a significant role in the future.
What about the simple low-cost resources and the amount of time that can be invested in them by many educators? Do you have any invitation that you have for all the many educators out there that could use any of these low-cost solutions, including RSS, blogs, and so, and what would be your advice to them?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you know. I mean, I'm in favor of this. I've been advocating this for a long time. It's not simply that they're simple and low cost, although I think that these are necessary conditions. It's that they form part of this larger communication system. You get out there, you look in the world of online learning, and you can on any given day see thousands and thousands and thousands of learning resources being produced all over the world. Some are glitzy, some are simple. There's a huge volume of resources being built out there. It's you know, the number of resources is staggering. We need a way to exchange these. I talk about these resources as objects from time to time, although strictly speaking that's not so. But I also talk about them as being words in a vocabulary of a multimedia language. And we need to learn to become fluent with that language. We need to learn not only to create words, but also to have conversations, to use these resources as a way of making our point. So being able to access the communication tools. Right now, these tools are blogs, RSS, wikis, and similar sorts of technology. Being able to access these tools and to begin a development of a capacity to communicate in what I would call a post-linguistic or multimedia language, I think this is going to be an essential skill set for educators in the future. Essential because this is the language our students will be speaking. And in order to teach, you have to be able to speak to them in their own language.
Good. And then what about the many, many, many young students that have actually access to a lot of time, creative ideas, and blogs? What is your advice to them on what to do with these instruments?
Read. Seriously. People talk about blogs and blogging as a writing tool, a writing practice. But the first and primary use of blogs in the blogosphere is to read, to expose yourself to as many ideas as possible. My own feeling is that the writing is something that flows out of that. Not everybody needs to have a blog. Not everybody needs to be writing a blog. But what they do need to be doing, what everybody needs to be doing, is tapping into as many ideas from as many different sources as possible. That's why I like RSS. RSS takes 1,000 voices and brings it to you almost as though it's a single voice. It allows you to sample and to hear many voices at once. And so having an RSS reader or using something like Blog Lines is kind of like plugging yourself into 1,000 different minds, 1,000 different communities, and it gives you that capacity to read a wide range of content. So my advice, read.
Thank you, Stephen. That was all very interesting. I appreciate you taking the time to answer my rapid-fire questions, and I hope this conversation can go on again in the future. This is all from me. Here is Robin Good from Rome, and I really want to say grazie to you for this wonderful exchange.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure, and I certainly hope to be back in Rome sometime so that we can sit down in one of the cafes and hoist a glass of red.